Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details.
Hello and welcome back, everyone, to another episode of Crime with Holly. It's your girl, Holly, and I am back today with another solved murder case for you. I don't have any case updates to give for today, so we are just going to jump right into today's episode. Today's episode is going to be a doozy, so buckle up, hold on tight, and grab a snack or two because this one is a lot. So without further ado, let's get into the details of the murder of Angie Dodge. Angie Ray Dodge was born on December 21, 1977, to Jack and Carol Dodge in Vancouver, Washington. She was the baby of the family, growing up with three older brothers, Brent, Todd, and Roger, who were always looking out for her. Those who knew Angie described her as the kind of person who would light up an entire room with her smile. And you guys are going to see what I mean by that because her smile was beautiful. She had an infectious energy, a vibrant personality, and a heart that seemed big enough for everyone. Friends and family say she always had a hug ready. She never met a stranger and genuinely cared about people from all walks of life. Although Angie was born in Washington, she didn't stay there for long. Her father served in the Navy, and like many military families, and I can vouch for this, the Dodges moved around frequently. When Angie was young, the family relocated to San Diego, California, where she attended preschool. Then, after 21 years of military service, Jack retired and moved the family back to his hometown of Idaho Falls, Idaho, where they finally were able to put down roots. Angie attended Idaho Falls High School, where she excelled academically. She was known for being incredibly intelligent and often spent her time tutoring younger students in things like math and English. Even at a young age, Angie was ambitious and goal-oriented, with dreams of one day becoming an entrepreneur. After graduating in 1995, Angie enrolled at Idaho State University in nearby Pocatello. During her freshman year, she continued to live at home with her parents, and she made the nearly hour-long commute to campus for classes. But academics weren't the only thing that Angie loved. She had a deep appreciation for the outdoors and an enthusiasm for life that was impossible to miss. Family camping trips were some of her favorite memories, and wherever they went, Angie could almost always be found near the water, usually because she was busy starting a water fight. Christmas was her favorite time of year, which was fitting considering her birthday fell just days before the holiday. The Dodge family celebrated both occasions together with large family gatherings that Angie absolutely adored. She loved making handmade necklaces decorated with ribbons and bells for family members and friends. And in true Angie fashion, she always made extra, just in case someone brought a guest. She never wanted anyone to feel left out. Her friends also have plenty of stories about Angie and her beloved Oldsmobile, a car that everyone nicknamed the Boat. They remember Angie cruising around town, completely carefree, often driving with one hand on the steering wheel and one foot hanging out the window. The boat was usually covered in mud, littered with fast food wrappers inside, and according to the Angie Dodge website, looked like it had survived a demolition derby. I think most of us can picture exactly what this car looked like. It was probably the kind of car that embarrassed your parents, but held some of your best memories with your friends. Not long before her death, Angie finally traded in the boat, and she purchased a brand new Chevy, an exciting milestone for a young woman who had her entire future ahead of her. In the summer of 1996, 18-year-old Angie Dodge was stepping into an exciting new chapter of her life. She had just finished her first year of college and moved into her very first apartment at 444 I Street in Idaho Falls. The apartment was located in a nice area not far from the Snake River, and Angie was thrilled to finally have a place of her own. I think we all could probably remember when we finally moved out of our parents' house, how exciting it was to have that little slice of freedom that we had never had before. We didn't have to answer to anybody, and it's just an overwhelmingly excited time. Angie was looking forward to her second year of college, experiencing a little more independence and figuring out life as a young adult. On the evening of June 12, 1996, Angie stopped by her parents' house around 9:15 p.m. for what seemed like a completely ordinary visit. While she was there, she talked to her mom, Carol, about her new apartment. Angie was excited about living on her own, but she also shared some of the worries that come with being an adult in the world for the very first time. Things like paying bills, supporting herself, and navigating adulthood. Years later, Carol recalled a moment from that evening that would stay with her forever. As they talked, Carol reached out and pulled Angie into a hug. Angie rested her head on her mother's shoulder, and the two gently rocked back and forth together, as if they were dancing. Carol whispered to her, quote, "You'll always be my baby." And Angie smiled and replied, quote, "I still whittle, huh, mommy?" You see, Angie always said whittle instead of little. It was something she had done for years, and it became her way of saying that no matter how old she got, she would always be her mother's little girl. Around 10:20 that night, Angie left to head back to her apartment. Before pulling away, she blew her mom a kiss. Carol blew one back and quietly whispered, "I love you." It's a moment that Carol has said she treasures so deeply, because it was the last time that she would see her daughter alive. Sometime after Angie returned to the little apartment she had only lived in for about 3 weeks, something horrific happened. The next morning, June 13th, Angie failed to show up for her shift at Beauty for All Seasons, a local beauty supply store where she worked. At first, her coworkers tried calling her, but they got no answer. As the morning went on, Angie still hadn't shown up, and two of her coworkers that she was very close with decided to stop by her apartment around 11 a.m. to make sure that she was okay. When they arrived, they noticed that the front door was unlocked. They let themselves inside, and after entering the apartment, they found 18-year-old Angie Dodge lying on the floor, partially clothed, and it was immediately apparent that she had been brutally attacked. They called 911, and when authorities arrived, they found no signs of a forced entry, which led them to believe that Angie had either left the door unlocked or she had willingly opened it for whoever was standing on the other side. What was immediately clear, however, was that Angie had fought for her life. Evidence inside the apartment showed that a violent struggle had taken place. Angie had been sexually assaulted, stabbed, and slashed a total of 14 times. Due to the violent nature of the attack, authorities questioned if this was a targeted attack instead of a random act of violence. Often in cases where a victim suffers this level of violence, emotions like anger, resentment, or obsession play a role. To investigators, the crime scene felt extremely personal. It was also unclear whether more than one person may have been involved. Despite the horrific nature of the crime, investigators believed they had evidence that could quickly lead them to a killer. Semen had been recovered from the scene, and a hair that did not belong to Angie was also found. In 1996, that gave investigators hope. They believed it was only a matter of time before they identified the person responsible, secured justice for Angie, and removed a dangerous predator from the streets. While authorities were on scene beginning their investigation, Carol Dodge had no idea that her world had already been shattered. Usually on days that Angie was working, Carol would call the beauty supply store to check in on her daughter and see how she was doing and just to chat and catch up. So on this day, Thursday, June 13th, 1996, Carol called like she often did. When another employee answered the phone, this is when Carol learned that Angie never showed up for work that day and that other employees had found her daughter dead inside her apartment. I cannot even begin to imagine the shock of hearing those words over the phone. And unfortunately, the Dodge family learned about Angie's murder before law enforcement had the opportunity to notify them personally. The family obviously was extremely devastated. Just hours earlier, they had been laughing, hugging, and talking about Angie's future. Now, that future had been stolen. Desperate for answers, Carol, Jack, and Angie's brothers rushed to the police station hoping someone could explain what was going on. Immediately, investigators with the Idaho Falls Police Department got to work trying to figure out who had raped and murdered Angie Dodge. They collected DNA samples from dozens of local men and spent months interviewing friends, acquaintances, coworkers, and family members in an attempt to determine whether Angie's killer was someone she knew or a complete stranger. But despite having what seemed like a solid DNA sample from the crime scene, investigators weren't getting anywhere. Months passed, then even more months, and still no arrests. Authorities compared the DNA evidence against more than 100 different samples, but every test came back the same. No match. One person investigators took a particular interest in early on was a man named Benjamin Hobbs, who was somewhat acquainted with Angie. His DNA was collected and compared to the evidence recovered from the crime scene, and it also was not a match. On top of that, Benjamin had an alibi for the night that Angie was murdered. For most investigations, that would have been enough to move on. But then, in January of 1997, Benjamin Hobbs was arrested for a violent attack on another woman. According to reports, Benjamin had sexually assaulted a woman at knife point, and that immediately got investigators' attention. After all, Angie had been sexually assaulted before being stabbed and slashed to death. The similarities were difficult to ignore, so investigators decided that they wanted to take another look at Benjamin Hobbs and the people closest to him. One of those people was a 20-year-old man named Christopher Tapp. Christopher and Benjamin were good friends and part of a local friend group that called themselves the River Rats, a nickname inspired by the Snake River that runs through Idaho Falls and served as one of their favorite hangout spots. And it's worth mentioning again that this Snake River was located not far from Angie's apartment on I Street. On January 7th, Christopher Tapp sat down for what would become his first of many police interviews. During that interview, investigators learned that Christopher had been with Angie at a gathering the night before she was murdered. Christopher denied having any involvement in her rape or murder. He also insisted that Benjamin Hobbs had nothing to do with it either. After that interview, Christopher was allowed to leave. But investigators were far from done with him. Following a second interview, Christopher's parents became concerned enough about the amount of attention police were paying to their son, and they hired an attorney to represent him moving forward. That turned out to be a smart decision, because before Christopher's third interview could ever begin, investigators showed up at his home, arrested him, and charged him as an accessory to a felony. At that point, police believed Christopher knew far more than he was admitting, and from there, his story began to change, and it changed a lot. During one interview, Christopher claimed that Benjamin Hobbs was responsible for Angie's murder and admitted that he had provided Benjamin with a false alibi for that night. But that version of events wouldn't last long. Soon after, Christopher changed his story again. This time, he claimed that he had actually been present when Benjamin had murdered Angie. According to Christopher, Benjamin killed Angie because she was allegedly trying to break up Benjamin's marriage. But then investigators received another major development. Both Christopher Tapp and Benjamin Hobbs were excluded from the DNA evidence found at the crime scene. Neither man's DNA matched the semen or the hair recovered from her apartment. At that point, rather than abandoning the theory altogether, investigators began to suspect that perhaps someone else in their friend group was responsible. That's when another name entered the picture, Jeremy Sargis. And once again, Christopher's story changed. Now, he claimed that Benjamin Hobbs and Jeremy Sargis had raped and murdered Angie together and that he had absolutely no involvement. Investigators quickly collected Jeremy's DNA and rushed it through testing. After about a week, those results came back and Jeremy was also excluded. His DNA did not match. And to make matters worse for investigators, Jeremy's alibi also checked out. At this point, Christopher had implicated himself, Benjamin, and Jeremy in various versions of the crime, yet none of the physical evidence supported any of those claims, and still the stories kept changing. When questioned yet again, Christopher offered yet another version of events. This time, he claimed that he, Jeremy, and Benjamin had all gone to Angie's apartment together. Christopher said that he held Angie down while Benjamin raped and killed her, and during all of this, apparently Jeremy had left the apartment. And then, in yet another twist, Christopher claimed that one of Benjamin's friends showed up during the assault, a man he identified only as Mike. The problem? Christopher said he didn't really know who Mike was. At this point, every time Christopher sat down with investigators, a different version of events seemed to emerge. New details would appear, new suspects would be named. Sometimes Christopher was involved, sometimes he wasn't. Sometimes it was Benjamin, sometimes it was Jeremy. Then there was Mike. So what was the frickin' truth? And was there any truth to any of these stories at all? And while I know it's frustrating listening to all of these conflicting accounts, if I'm being honest, it's like a lot to tell. And I know you guys are probably not keeping anything straight, and that's okay, because it really doesn't matter in the end. So just imagine, though, how investigators felt trying to sort through all of these different stories, trying to take little fragments from each one and piece it together to figure out what the truth really was. More importantly, imagine how Angie Dodge's family felt. Months had passed since her murder, and they still had no real answers about who had taken their daughter from them. From the investigator's perspective, however, there was one thing they kept coming back to: Christopher Tapp. He had repeatedly inserted himself into the story. whether he was claiming to be present, claiming to participate, or claiming to witness the attack, he kept placing himself at the center of the crime in one way or another. So investigators became increasingly convinced that Christopher knew more than he was admitting. On January 30th, Christopher Tapp took his fifth polygraph test. And it was during this questioning, according to lawumich.edu, that police told Christopher that he could possibly get a more lenient sentence if he had been in fear of his life after witnessing the attack on Angie. Eventually, he says that he cut Angie across the breast because Benjamin Hobbs threatened to kill him. What I find particularly interesting is what happened next. Christopher was reportedly told that he had passed the polygraph examination, yet according to the officer's own written report, investigators wrote down that they still believed Christopher was being deceptive about his involvement in the crime. And honestly, when you look at the totality of these interviews, it raises some serious questions. Christopher had already told multiple contradictory stories. Then investigators introduced the idea that he might receive leniency if he admitted that he was acting out of fear. And shortly thereafter, Christopher began describing himself as someone who participated only because he was afraid of Benjamin Hobbs. Now, I'm not saying that's what happened, but when you combine the shifting stories, the pressure of repeated interrogations, and promises of potential leniency, it's easy to see why some people later questioned whether portions of Christopher's confession were being influenced or even coerced by investigators. Regardless, law enforcement believed that they had enough to move forward. On February 3rd, 1997, just 7 months after Angie Dodge was murdered, 21-year-old Christopher Tapp was charged with first-degree murder, rape, and use of a deadly weapon in the commission of a felony. And despite all of the DNA evidence pointing away from him, Christopher Tapp was now facing the possibility of spending the rest of his life behind bars.
Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details.
More than a year after his arrest, Christopher Tapp's trial finally began on May 12, 1998, and the prosecution's case largely centered around one thing, Christopher's own words. Jurors spent days listening to the many recorded interviews and confessions in which Christopher provided version after version of what he claimed had happened to Angie Dodge. Meanwhile, the defense argued that those confessions couldn't be trusted. Christopher's attorney pointed out that his client had been interrogated for more than 100 hours over the course of 23 days. And when you watch those interviews from the beginning, it's clear that investigators weren't initially focused on Christopher as the killer. Their attention was largely directed toward Benjamin Hobbs. They wanted Christopher to tell them that Benjamin was responsible. During those interrogations, investigators repeatedly told Christopher that Benjamin had already placed him at the crime scene and implicated him in the murder. The problem? That wasn't true at all. It was a lie designed to get Christopher talking. Now, law enforcement officers are legally allowed to use certain deceptive tactics during interrogations. That's not against the law. The idea is that a guilty person may crack under pressure and tell the truth. But critics argue that those same tactics can sometimes produce false confessions, especially when someone is young, scared, confused, or simply desperate to end the interrogation. And that's exactly what Christopher's defense argued had happened here with him. In addition to the confession tapes, prosecutors called a woman named Destiny Osborne to testify. Destiny told the jury about a party that she had attended just days after Angie's murder, and according to her testimony, she overheard Christopher Tapp and Benjamin Hobbs discussing the crime. However, Destiny also admitted that she had been under the influence of drugs during the party. Despite that, she claimed she distinctly remembered Benjamin saying that he killed Angie because she owed him money for methamphetamine. But that testimony raised some questions. Christopher had previously told investigators that Angie didn't use drugs, which directly contradicted the motive Destiny described. So jurors were left to determine how much weight they wanted to give testimony from someone who acknowledged being high at the time of the alleged conversation. Christopher himself never took the stand in his own defense. However, the defense did present a witness who claimed Christopher had been with a woman on the night Angie was murdered. That account was later supported by Christopher's former girlfriend, who testified that she had actually caught Christopher and the other woman together in bed. If true, it would have provided Christopher with an alibi, but prosecutors pushed back. They presented one of Christopher's friends who testified that the witness had the dates mixed up and that the incident with the other woman occurred on a completely different night. After both sides delivered their closing arguments, the case was handed over to the jury for deliberations. The panel, made up of 9 women and 3 men, began deliberating. On May 28, 1998, they returned with their verdict: guilty on all 3 charges. Christopher Tapp was convicted of first-degree murder, rape, and use of a deadly weapon in the commission of a felony. Later that year, he was sentenced to 30 years in prison for the murder conviction and an additional 10 years for the rape. Over the years that followed, Christopher continued fighting his conviction through multiple appeals. Every single one was denied. But despite the conviction, a major problem remained: the DNA evidence. None of the DNA recovered from Angie's apartment matched Christopher Tapp. And because of that, both investigators and the Dodge family were left with a lingering question. If Christopher was involved, who actually committed the crime? Many came to believe that Christopher knew more than he was telling investigators, and that he may have been protecting the real killer. And because of that uncertainty, Angie's case was never truly considered solved. In many ways, it remained an open wound. Then, in 2007, a new chapter began. After years of maintaining that his confession had been coerced, Christopher's case was taken up by the Idaho Innocence Project. The organization reviewed the case and came to the same conclusion many others had reached: that serious questions existed about the reliability of Christopher's statements. They pushed for additional DNA testing and a fresh look at the evidence. Then, in 2009, 13 years after Angie Dodge was murdered, the DNA profile recovered from the crime scene was finally entered into CODIS. And for those unfamiliar with CODIS, which I think most people know, but I'm going to say it anyways, it stands for the Combined DNA Index System. It is a national database that allows law enforcement agencies across the country to compare DNA profiles from crime scenes against DNA collected from convicted offenders and other unsolved cases. So what this meant for Angie's case was that if the person responsible had committed another crime and their DNA had been entered into the system, it would populate a match. But unfortunately, there wasn't a match. Despite that setback, Carol Dodge refused to give up. She had spent years searching for answers, and she wasn't about to stop now. According to CBS News, Carol eventually reached out to a renowned DNA expert named Greg Hampikian. Greg had built a reputation for his work in forensic genetics, and after connecting with Carol, the two began working together to push for additional testing and new investigative methods. Carol and Greg teamed up and put the pressure on the authorities to use a new at that time, but controversial search process called familial DNA. This would look for anyone who may be related to Angie's killer. Greg ran into a roadblock with this because Idaho didn't allow familial DNA searches through their criminal database. So Greg made an even bigger controversial move and suggested they did a familial search through public databases. Today, that might not sound groundbreaking, but back then, it was a pretty radical idea. In 2014, investigators and Greg began using Ancestry.com and other genealogical resources in an effort to find relatives to the unknown DNA donor. And for the first time in years, they got a hit. That lead pointed them toward a man named Michael Usry, a filmmaker living in New Orleans. And not just any filmmaker. Michael's work often centered around horror, violence, and murder. One of his films, called Murderabilia, focused on the fatal stabbing of a young woman. Now, by itself, that doesn't mean anything, of course, but if you remember, Christopher Tapp had repeatedly mentioned a mysterious man named Mike during his interviews. So naturally, investigators took a very close look at Michael. And to their surprise, Michael had actually been in Idaho around the time that Angie was murdered. More and more things with this lead seemed incredibly promising. In December of 2014, investigators showed up at Michael's door. They questioned him about his whereabouts and informed him that he was being investigated in connection with a homicide in Idaho. After answering their questions, Michael voluntarily went to the local police station where investigators collected a DNA sample before driving him back home. Then he waited. About a month later, Michael received an email from the lead investigator. His DNA was not a match. While Michael wasn't surprised that he had been cleared, he was stunned to learn that investigators had focused on him because of a partial familial DNA connection, meaning somewhere out there in his family tree, there appeared to be someone genetically connected to the unknown suspect. Following the experience, Michael decided to make a documentary about what had happened to him and about Angie's case. And in a twist that I absolutely love, Carol Dodge agreed to participate. As the two spent more time together, the project evolved. Instead of focusing solely on Michael's experience, it became centered on Carol's relentless fight to find her daughter's killer. Now, I wasn't able to locate the finished documentary, so I'm not sure whether it was ever completed or officially released, but regardless, I think it's remarkable that something positive emerged from such a difficult situation. A mother searching for answers and a man who had been wrongly thrust into the investigation formed an unlikely friendship, and together they continued pushing for the truth. As Carol learned more about DNA evidence and the details of the case, she began to question something she once believed. She started to wonder whether Christopher Tapp was actually completely innocent. The more she looked at the evidence, the more convinced she became that an innocent man might be sitting behind bars while the real killer remained free. Then, in May of 2016, Christopher Tapp's attorney, led by John Thomas from the Bonneville County Public Defender's Office, filed a motion for post-conviction relief. The defense presented a substantial amount of evidence that they argued showed Christopher had never been at the crime scene. They also renewed their argument that Christopher's confession had been the product of coercion, deception, and relentless interrogation tactics. Months later, on March 22, 2017, attorney John Thomas reached an agreement with Bonneville County District Attorney Danny Clark. As part of that agreement, Christopher's rape conviction was vacated. His murder sentence was reduced to time served. After spending more than two decades behind bars, Christopher Tapp walked out of prison a free man. But the fight wasn't over. Christopher was seeking complete exoneration, and more troubling information about his case continued to surface. One of the prosecution's key witnesses, the woman who testified that she overheard Christopher and Benjamin discussing Angie's murder, later claimed that investigators had threatened her with drug charges before she testified. A revelation that only added more questions to a case that was already filled with way too many. And despite Christopher's release, one very important question still remained unanswered. If Christopher Tapp didn't kill Angie Dodge, then who did? After his release, the search for Angie's real killer intensified. The Idaho Falls Police Department and the Idaho Innocence Project continued working tirelessly to identify the person whose DNA had been sitting in evidence for more than two decades. Investigators took another deep dive into Michael Usry's family tree. After combing through relatives and branches of the family tree, they came up with a list of six men who could potentially be connected to the unknown DNA profile. This time, instead of knocking on doors and asking questions, investigators took a different approach. They quietly followed each of these men and collected discarded DNA samples without their knowledge. For days, they tracked their movements, gathering cigarette butts, soda cans, plastic straws, and even discarded chewing tobacco. One by one, the samples were tested, and one by one, all six were eliminated. Every single one of them came back as a negative match. At that point, investigators started asking themselves a new question. What if the family tree wasn't complete? What if someone was missing? As they dug deeper into the genealogy records, they discovered that a woman who had once been married into the Usry family had a child with a member of that family. However, after the marriage ended, the child was adopted by a stepfather and given a different last name. Because of that name change, he had essentially been hidden from the family tree investigators were working from. That man's name was Brian Dripps. And when investigators finally learned that name, everything changed. Because Brian Dripps wasn't a stranger. He was someone that police had already spoken to in June of 1996. In fact, Brian had lived directly across the street from Angie's apartment. At the time of the murder, Brian was 31 years old. Investigators had questioned him shortly after Angie's body was discovered, and Brian claimed he knew nothing about what had happened. But despite living directly across the street from the victim, police never collected his DNA. And shortly after Angie's murder, Brian moved away from Idaho and relocated to California. It was one of those moments that, looking back, is incredibly difficult to comprehend. The man responsible had been right there from the very beginning. Investigators had spoken to him, and somehow he slipped away. By the time they tracked Brian down all those years later, he was living back in Idaho, roughly 300 miles from Idaho Falls. Just as they had done with the other men on their list, investigators began quietly surveilling him. Eventually, they recovered a discarded cigarette butt. The DNA from the cigarette was tested, and finally, after 23 years, investigators got the answer that they had been searching for. It was a match. The DNA on the cigarette matched the DNA recovered from Angie Dodge's murder scene 23 years earlier. The DNA on that cigarette matched the DNA recovered from Angie Dodge's murder scene. 23 years. That's how long it took to connect Brian Dripps to a crime investigators had been trying to solve since 1996. And honestly, what an absolute gut punch. To learn that the killer had been interviewed within days of the murder and lived across the street from Angie the entire time had to be devastating for everyone involved. Not to mention, his DNA was never collected, even though he lived right there. When investigators brought Brian in for questioning, he initially denied any involvement. But detectives noticed something. Although Brian appeared calm on the surface and was talking very calmly and was acting real cool, his hands were shaking uncontrollably. After hours of denying being involved, investigators finally straight up just told him, like, listen, we have your DNA at the crime scene. According to Detective Sage Albright, the moment Brian realized investigators had linked him to the crime scene, there was an immediate shift in his demeanor, and eventually he broke. Brian confessed. He admitted that he murdered Angie Dodge and that he had acted alone, which meant that Christopher Tapp had absolutely nothing to do with the crime. Brian told investigators that he entered Angie's apartment intending to sexually assault her at knife point. Now, he claimed that it was during the assault the knife was being held against her throat and he accidentally cut her. But the injuries that Angie suffered tell a much, much different story. This was not a minor wound. Angie endured a vicious and violent attack and was nearly decapitated. To describe her injuries as simply an accidental cut during the assault minimizes the horrific reality of what she truly endured. Brian claimed that he had been heavily intoxicated and under the influence of drugs at the time. He said that he couldn't remember much of the attack and insisted that many of the details were a blur. But regardless of what he remembered, the evidence spoke for itself. 2 months after Brian's arrest, Christopher Tapp returned to court. By this time, he wasn't there as a defendant. He was there to finally clear his name. And in July of 2019, Christopher Tapp was fully exonerated. After spending more than 20 years in prison for a crime he did not commit, he was officially declared innocent on all charges. The case also made history. It became the first known case in the entire world where genealogical DNA testing directly led to the exoneration of a wrongfully convicted person. Following the hearing, Christopher and Carol Dodge shared a moment that many people found incredibly moving. Carol congratulated him and embraced him. And when you consider where they started, that moment becomes even more powerful. Years earlier, after Christopher's conviction, Carol had publicly referred to him as a monster. Now, standing together after the truth had finally emerged, there was a hug. To me, that moment represents so many emotions all at once. Relief, forgiveness, sorrow, and the shared pain of two people whose lives had been forever altered by the same tragedy. Finally, in February of 2021, Brian Dripps pleaded guilty to the rape and murder of Angie Dodge. His attorney asked the court for leniency, pointing out that Brian had never been arrested for any other crimes after Angie's murder. The defense also argued that Brian had been struggling with heavy alcohol and drug use at the time and was dealing with the emotional fallout of his wife leaving him. But for Angie's family, none of that changed what had happened. On June 8th, 2021, Brian Drips was sentenced to 20 years to life in prison as part of a plea agreement. He was also ordered to register as a sex offender if he is ever released. It is believed that because of Brian Drips' declining health, he may never even reach his first parole eligibility date and will likely spend the remainder of his life behind bars, as he should. But while Brian's conviction finally brought answers, there was still another injustice that needed to be addressed: the wrongful conviction of Brian Tapp. According to CBS News, on June 13, 2022, officials in Idaho Falls agreed to pay Christopher Tapp $11.7 million to settle a lawsuit he filed against the city and the Idaho Falls Police Department in October of 2020. The city initially asked for the lawsuit to be dismissed. Instead, they ultimately chose to settle. And while no amount of money can ever return the 21 years Christopher lost, the settlement was at least an acknowledgement that a tremendous wrong had been done. Christopher Tapp once said in an interview with Dateline that he didn't want to be remembered as the guy from the Angie Dodge case. He wanted to be remembered as an advocate. According to NBC News, after his exoneration, Christopher dedicated himself to helping others who had been wrongfully convicted. He pushed lawmakers in Idaho and other states to pass legislation that would provide fair compensation to people who had lost years of their lives behind bars for crimes they did not commit. But more than anything, Christopher wanted to move forward. After losing over 20 years of his life to a wrongful conviction, he finally had his freedom. He finally had the opportunity to build the life that had been taken from him. Tragically, that opportunity would be cut short. On October 29th, 2023, Christopher Tapp died right here in Las Vegas, where I live. Initially, his death was ruled an accident after he was found unresponsive inside of a suite at Resorts World. Authorities believe that he had suffered a head injury after falling, because that's what they were told. But as the investigation continued, the narrative began to change. The Clark County Coroner's Office ultimately ruled Christopher's death a homicide caused by blunt force trauma to the head. Reports indicated that Christopher had suffered multiple brain bleeds. According to 8 News Now, retired professional wrestler and former congressional candidate Daniel Rodmer allegedly attacked Christopher inside a bedroom during a Halloween party. Authorities allege that after the altercation, Daniel and another man exited the room and told other partygoers not to call security. Christopher reportedly remained on the floor, suffering from a severe head injury for an extended period of time before Resorts World security was finally contacted. When security arrived, they were told that Christopher had simply slipped and fallen. And for a time, that's exactly what authorities believed had happened. Investigators initially concluded that Christopher's injuries were the result of an accidental fall related to drug and alcohol use. However, it would later come out that authorities believed Daniel Rodmer assaulted Christopher after Christopher allegedly offered Daniel's model stepdaughter cocaine during the party. As the investigation unfolded, text messages allegedly sent by Daniel's wife surfaced. In one message, she wrote, quote, "I watched you nearly murder somebody, and I had to take your effing hands off from his neck as he laid there, and you ran away, and I spent the next 2 hours trying to take care of him. Nobody should have to watch their husband murder somebody," end quote. Daniel's attorney have fought to keep those text messages out of the court, but a judge denied that motion. Last month, Daniel Rodmer was back in court seeking dismissal of the murder charge against him. According to Fox 5 Las Vegas, his attorney argued that findings from the Clark County Coroner's Office showed that Christopher's injuries were the result of drug and alcohol use and were not suspicious in nature. The defense also alleged that the investigators violated attorney-client and spousal privilege by intercepting text messages between Daniel, his attorney, and his wife. Beyond that hearing, there has been very little public information released regarding how the judge ultimately ruled. What we do know is that Daniel Rodmere remains out of custody on a $200,000 bond as the case continues to move through the court system. And honestly, I think one of the most heartbreaking parts of this story is that Christopher survived one of the most devastating miscarriages of justice imaginable. He lost over 20 years of his life for a crime he did not commit. He fought to clear his name. He helped change the conversation around wrongful convictions. He became exactly what he said he wanted to be, an advocate. And then, just a few short years after finally gaining his freedom, his life came to a tragic end. Christopher Tapp deserved far more time than he was given. And while many people will always remember him because of the Angie Dodge case, I hope he's also remembered for the work that he did after his exoneration, and the people he helped, and the determination he showed in rebuilding a life that had been taken from him. And I will keep you guys posted if there is more information that comes out about the updates on Christopher's case. So getting back to Angie's case, one thing I always say that I admire in cases like this is when a family chooses to channel unimaginable grief into helping others. And that's exactly what Carol Dodge and her son, Brent, did. Together, they created a nonprofit organization called Five for Hope. The organization's mission is to raise money for underfunded cold case investigations and provide support to agencies and organizations working to solve unsolved crimes. If you would like to learn more about Five for Hope, I'll include a link to the Angie Dodge website in the description of this episode. At just 18 years old, Angie Dodge had her entire life ahead of her. She was a daughter, a sister, a friend, and a young woman with dreams, goals, and endless possibilities. All of that was stolen from her in a single act of violence. But Brian Dripps' actions didn't just devastate Angie's family. They changed Christopher Tapp's life forever as well. For years, Christopher sat behind bars for a crime that he did not commit. While he lost birthdays, holidays, relationships, opportunities, and precious years of freedom, the actual killer was living his life without consequences. For more than two decades, Brian Dripps believed that he had gotten away with murder. And if not for advances in DNA technology and the groundbreaking use of genetic genealogy, he very well might have. Cases like Angie's remind us just how powerful these scientific advances can be. We're seeing more and more cold cases solved through genealogical DNA testing, bringing answers to families who have waited years, sometimes decades, for justice. And while nothing can ever undo the pain caused by Angie's murder, this case stands as a powerful reminder that the truth has a way of resurfacing. Sometimes it takes far longer than it should. Sometimes justice is delayed for decades. But thanks to the determination of people like Carol Dodge, investigators who refused to quit, and advances in forensic science, the truth in Angie's case was finally uncovered. And Angie Dodge will never be forgotten. Crimesters, that is all that I have for this week's episode. Thank you so much for listening to this case. Make sure that you are a part of my private Facebook group. You can find it by searching Crime with Holly Podcast Discussion Group. In there, I share all information and pictures pertaining to the cases that I cover, and I also encourage all members to share all things true crime. If you want to keep up with what is happening in my life, you can find me on Instagram at CrimeAHolly. And if you would like more bite-sized true crime content, you can follow me on TikTok at crimewithholly.podcast. Thank you all so, so much. Always remember to be aware and take care. Bye-bye.